This podcast is brought to you by A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. By the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan, come together to worship and serve. And by Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today.
Today we welcome Jonathan Merritt, one of America's most popular writers on issues of faith and culture. He is an author of several critically acclaimed books, including Learning to Speak God from Scratch, Why Sacred Words Are Vanishing, and How We Can Revive Them, named Book of the Year by the Englewood Review of Books. In addition to the written word, Jonathan regularly contributes commentary to television, print, and radio news outlets. He's been interviewed by ABC World News, CNN, MSNBC, and now, The Vicar's Crossing.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you may be listening. We welcome you back to another edition of the Vicar's Crossing podcast. The Vicar's Crossing is a virtual space where faith intersects with the public square. And welcome back to the fourth episode of season 7. And my name is Rob Henderson, and I serve as the priest at Holy Trinity St. Stephen's Anglican Church in London.
And if you take a look at me, what you'll see is Kevin George. I am also a priest. I am a vicar. I hang out at St. Aidan's Anglican Church in the northwest corner of the city.
And my name is Ian. I'm the person who edits this podcast together and gets it out into your ear holes. I hope you're having a good day wherever you are.
Careful.
All right, boys. Good to be back together again. Good to be back after a little break and our fourth episode of season 7, Kevin.
Yes, and well, fourth episode, I should explain and give a little disclaimer before you say a word about who we're bringing up here. First of all, we've missed a few weeks. So I did have a couple of emails, which was heartening to know that our tens of listeners are paying attention, saying, have you guys decided to quit the podcast? And no, what's happened is we did record a podcast 4 or 5 weeks ago, and it turned out that sometimes bringing folks on from America and so on, I don't always do the necessary research that I should have done. And so we had recorded an episode with Karen Swallow Pryor, and I heard from some good friends of the podcast asking me if I understood who we were platforming. And once I took a look at Karen and what some of her work has been, it was clear to me that that's not somebody we should be elevating. She's a very nice person. She was very kind to us. We're grateful that she made the time. But given some of the things that she said and done, which are really quite extreme, we didn't feel comfortable. So we yanked that episode. And then Rob had a funeral, and then I had a funeral, and then I had another funeral. And so sometimes being a vicar also means life gets in the way of recording. And so we've missed a few episodes here. But we're back at it. I do apologize for the business with Karen. For any of you who may have picked up that episode and wondered if we'd lost our marbles, we have not. I just didn't do the due diligence that that we should have done. And we should also note, I think this is the first episode this season where we got producer Ian actually on the screen, isn't it? Or did we have you on?
Yeah, first or second, because producer Ian's a busy guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I don't. Yeah. It's been a hot minute since we last recorded, and I can't remember which the last episode was that I was on.
We're glad to be together today, and we're very glad to be able to welcome our guest for the podcast today, Jonathan Merritt, who will be joining us in a few minutes. And Jonathan is one of America's most popular writers on issues of faith and culture, right up our alley here at the Vicar's Crossing. He is the author of several critically acclaimed books, including Learning to Speak God from Scratch, Why Sacred Words Are Vanishing, and How We Can Revive Them. And he has also published more than 3,000 articles in outlets such as the New York Times, USA Today, BuzzFeed, The Washington Post, The Daily Beast, and Christianity Today. So we're really happy to have Jonathan with us, and he'll be joining us in just a minute.
Yeah, you know, you can pick him up on CNN, ABC, everywhere. The guy's everywhere. What a great guy. Anyway, before we go too far, we do want to do our land acknowledgement. We want to acknowledge that the lands upon which we record this podcast are the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, Lenape, Wakanata, Wandaram peoples, and are connected with the London Township and Somber Treaties of 1796 and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant Wampum. And we acknowledge that these lands continue to be home to diverse Indigenous peoples whom we recognize as contemporary stewards of this land and vital contributors of our society, people with whom we wish to do the difficult work of living in the present moment and learning to walk together towards reconciliation.
And while we would love to say that the three of us are responsible for everything you see here in the Vicar's Crossing,
we're not.
It's not just us.
It's not just us.
We have some great sponsors that support us, and we're so appreciative of that.
It's true.
We just want to take a moment to thank them. First, to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family owned and operated. And our thanks to Dave Mullen and the staff at A. Miller George. Good to have you aboard with us again this year.
Great guy. Always good. We have our sponsor, our new sponsor for 2022. What year are we in? 2022 it's 2022, 2023 season, we'll say. Anyway, so we have the Diocese of Huron, a place we know a little bit about because Rob and I both happen to be priests there. A community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, from Grand Bend to Port Rowan and all points in between come together to worship and serve.
And last, but certainly not least, we want to say a big thank you to Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. And Trisha Lister was a wonderful human being who hooked us up with that. So thank you to them over there. If you need any cleaning done, let them know. And they got
it. Can't think of anybody who could clean better than Molly Maid.
That's so real.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Great. And again, thanks to all our sponsors and for you listening. We really appreciate your support over our seasons here at the Vicar's Crossing. And we're going to look forward to chatting with Jonathan Barrett, who I think is about ready to join us. So let's go.
All right. Let's bring in this young fellow from New York City.
And here's Jonathan. We're so happy to have him on the podcast today in the Vicar's Crossing. Jonathan, welcome aboard. We're so glad you're here and looking forward to talk about the book and other things. And you're in New York, right? Is that where you're?
I am. I'm in today, sunny New York City. So right here in Manhattan. I live on the campus of the General Theological Seminary of the Episcopal Church. So
yeah. Oh, right on.
It's gorgeous here today.
Well, welcome to Canada. Well, yeah, sort of.
Virtually. Yeah. It's a pleasure.
What do we get? I think we should have Jonathan up here for like some big thing, a Vicar's Crossing event where Jonathan speaks in the city of London. We're the second most favorite London in the world, you know, London, Ontario.
Oh my gosh, the second most. Is there a third?
But I don't know. But we don't even talk about them. I mean, anyway, listen, we really appreciate you making the time for us. And if I can say, I really appreciate you getting a hold of me an hour ago to let me know the Zoom wasn't working because it took me 45 minutes. Before we recorded this podcast, Jonathan reached out and says, I'm getting an error message, and I had to totally uninstall and reinstall Zoom, and I just got it done like 15 minutes ago. So wow. thank you, because we'd have been screwed for you. Once again, you saved the day.
I'm glad that we got it fixed. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
No, that's right. So we're thankful. Yeah. Listen, so much to talk about, Jonathan. We really love the book, Learning to Speak God from Scratch, which is desperately needed. But I thought we'd start today. This episode is dropping on Monday, the day before the midterm elections in the United States. We here in Canada watch American politics like we watch hockey. Like, it's very exciting. It's really quite something. The sad part is that some of it is starting to spill over, unfortunately. Some of this right-wing sort of stuff is really having an effect here as well. Mm. So much happening in the United States right now. I think people are so polarized. I read last evening that 60% of Americans will have someone on the ballot who is an election denier, which is just shocking to me that many of the candidates themselves will be election deniers. Mm-hmm. The support for these folks from the religious right is sort of fascinating to us. Like, it really just sort of speaks to, we talk about the intersection of faith in the public square on this podcast, and obviously the influence of Christian nationalism in the United States and here in Canada is really something. I was interested in a piece you wrote in the RNS, the Religious News Service, in September about the Republican governors and DeSantis sending people north on buses and planes, DeSantis flying them to Martha's Vineyard where he thought he could own the libs by sending them there. Well, we're pleased to see this little Episcopalian church step up and take them in. Yeah. Of DeSantis, you wrote, you said he likes to play the part of a proud Christian on the campaign trail, even commandeering Bible verses in stump speeches. But apparently when it comes to the Bible's repeated commands along the lines of do not mistreat or oppress the immigrant, he's willing to make some very important compromises. Yeah. Of course, their willingness to compromise goes beyond those issues. I mean, Herschel Walker and is now leading in Georgia in the latest polls, and he's been quite outspoken about abortion. And yet now we've a couple people come forward to say he's paid for their abortions. It seems to have little or no impact on him in terms of the religious right. Like, it doesn't matter just how bad these people are. It's not the right word, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about how things are on the ground there right now in the United States. As someone who's a follower of Jesus like you and has written so well about it, like, how are you doing? Like, how are you holding in there with all that?
Yeah, you know, it's a weird time to be living in America, much less to be a Christian living in America. I've never before, I was just talking yesterday to a good friend of mine who lives in Georgia, and we were both talking about how many of our friends are trying to get to Europe. Mm. And that to me is, you know,
like, you mean move to Europe?
Yeah, just to move. Really? I have a friend who just moved to Portugal. You know, there are a lot of countries that do these kind of golden parachute kind of, or whatever they call them, golden passport, programs where you can spend a certain amount of money. You live there for a few years, you get an EU passport. And I just never in my life thought that I would see that people trying to get out of America and go to a European country and live in a European country. And, you know, there are a lot of these countries, their democracies are just so much more well-run than ours is right now. And, you know, not in every case, but in many cases, their leaders are less bombastic. I think in particular, a parliamentary system has a kind of not just a stability, but an ability to change more rapidly than ours does, where you have to get 60 votes in the Senate in order to do anything, or you've got a judiciary that can sort of unwind progress.
Highly politicized judiciary.
Yeah, a highly politicized judiciary. So it's a strange time to be here. It's, you know, you brought up something about Christian nationalism and about the religious right. You know, that to me is shocking, but not surprising. I've been writing about all of these sort of developments for 15 years now, and when I first was writing, I wrote a book in 2012 called A Faith of Our Own, Following Jesus Beyond the Culture Wars. And, you know, I said a lot of this stuff was happening, that the things that we were seeing among politically mobilized conservative Christians in the United States was not about principle, but was about power. It was about cultural control. It was about social domination. And of course, now we've seen all of this come to bear. At the time when I wrote that book, people thought I was extremist. Yeah, that I was exaggerating, that I was being crazy. And now you look at that book and you go, gosh, you didn't get far enough.
Yeah.
So it's been something interesting to watch. You know, when I was a kid in the late 1990s, there was a phrase that was really, really popular among the religious right. I grew up in the religious right. My dad was the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, 2000 and 2002. So, you know, the largest evangelical denomination in the United States. And a TV preacher, you know, bragged that he was to the right of Ronald Reagan. That was the house I grew up in.
Yeah.
So when I was growing up, there was this sort of common phrase when evangelicals talked about politics, they would say character counts. And they used that as a kind of bullwhip to attack, to fillet Democrats religious progressives who were supporting Bill Clinton. Right. And of course, if you look at the character issues that we were seeing in the White House and the Clinton administration, you know, it was sort of Pollyanna
yes.
compared to what we saw in the Trump administration. But suddenly a lot of those arguments were like conveniently swapped out, right? Now we're talking about King Cyrus and the King David and the way that God uses yeah. leaders who are sinful or broken. Yeah. And it's amazing how pliable the scripture, the logic can be in the hands of someone who is dead committed to a particular political end.
Right. And usually not willing to treat scripture with the same pliability for any other reason.
Yeah, that's right.
So, well, thank you for that. Like I say, I just know that you know, a lot of these guests like yourself that we have on, people who are doing really solid work on the ground in terms of following in the way of Jesus and faith in the public square and all that. I just know it must be a really difficult time, like to navigate all that. And, you know, our prayers are that, you know, the midterm somehow it holds.
I guess. You know, I had a friend the other day say something to this effect, and I think it was really true, that at least, and I'm just going to speak from the American context, but my guess is it's probably true in most Western countries, most North American countries, is we can no longer speak of Christianity. Mm-hmm. We have to speak of Christianities.
That's right.
There are Christianities now that are so distinct from each other that we can't talk about them anymore as a monolithic thing. I mean, I have oftentimes so much more in common mm-hmm. with friends who are not Christian but share basic values about human decency and human dignity and care for the least of these than I do people who call themselves my Christian brother, my Christian mm-hmm. sister. And so whatever they're practicing, it is related to what I'm practicing. And yet it's so distinct that we have to begin to differentiate it. Otherwise, when a person like me walks into a room, and it happens all the time in a place like New York City, and somebody finds out that I'm a Christian, or they look at my Instagram account and they see me talking about something that's Christian, they immediately make this connection with the people that they've seen on Fox News, you know, running their mouth about God knows what bigotry.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the people that they've seen marching in Charlottesville and suddenly they have all kinds of feelings and assumptions about me that couldn't be less true. And so we've got to begin to talk about Christianity in a way that differentiates the people who are on the extremes, who I think are using that name, they're instrumentalizing that name, but as a result, they're doing a lot of damage to those of us who are trying to follow Jesus in a very different way.
Right. Well, and I think that takes us to your book. I mean, I think that's the whole point, is the language that we use when we talk about our faith or about our spirituality is really quite critical. And so your book, which is on the wall here, Learning to Speak God from Scratch, is really a great book in terms of calling us to consider the words that we use. The book, again, is called Learning to Speak God from Scratch, Why Sacred Words Are Vanishing and How We Can Revive Them. In the book, you describe what it was like for you moving to New York City from the South, and how affected you were specifically in terms of now being among sort of 8 million people, pardon me, many of whom were not accustomed to religious or spiritual language. You write in the book, I've been meeting people from all over with similar histories of belief who feel they too have been struck mute in a strange land. Terms like sin and hell have become so negative they lodge in our throats. Others like belief and salvation have been uttered so often we don't know what they mean anymore. Definitions and connotations of words like mercy and love can no longer be assumed. So I wonder if you can say more about your own experience of coming up against those who do not understand the very particular language of those of us who live in church land and tend to assume that the language we use is universal, that people understand it. And why, you know, that conversation and this book is so important at this time.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of different kinds of sacred speech. But if you were to put them into two categories, you know, a lot of people think that what you're talking about is like Christianese, mm-hmm. so which is not what I'm writing about.
No,
you know, it's not like bless your heart. It's not these kinds of culturally, you know, insular phrases that you'll often hear in churches. Although I think many of those have sort of fallen away as well. It is just basic moral, religious, spiritual language. So the kind of language that points to the immaterial or the metaphysical, to it points to kind of value and principle and the deeper things, the real. So even words like courage and kindness and compassion and grace, there are those words that are more positive. And then there are the words that we find in the spiritual vocabulary, the vocabulary of faith, as you mentioned, like sin. So like, how do we name? We're just talking about all of these terrible things in the world. And so most of us, I think, would say, well, the world as it is not as it ought to be, right? Mm-hmm. It's not as it ought to be. And so then what do you call the ways in which the world deviates from its oughtness? What do you call the things that push us from oughtness to isness, right? What do you call that? And it's not the best word. It's not a word that that is lacking in problems, but we as Christians in our tradition have called that sin. And so it allows us to name it. And when we name it, we can create space around it. We can observe it. We can think about it. We can ask questions about what we do about it. We can begin to compare the rhythms and patterns of our own lives and see the ways in which we live into those chasms of difference, the ways that we contribute to those things. But what happens is when those words fall away because we're embarrassed of them, or they begin to take on a kind of a connotation, because words don't just have definition,
right,
which is sort of the way that a word is used, the sort of meaning that's given to a word by usage. They also have connotation, the way they feel when they come out of our mouths. So when the connotation becomes so negative or so dark or so twisted, then we really lose sight of the definition. It kind of changes it, and we can't use that word. So then what happens when we can't speak of the difference between is and ought? What happens is we begin to drift toward the isness, right? We begin to we lose ourselves because we don't think about the things that we don't talk about. We're not shaped by things if we don't talk about those things. So when we don't talk about grace, we become less gracious. When we don't talk about courage, we become less courageous. When we don't talk about kindness, we become less kind. And so a lot of times, you know, we have conversations like the previous one and we go, God, what is happening in this world? Oftentimes we forget that sometimes the reality that we see around us, however disheartening it may be, is influenced by and shaped by the way that we speak or the way that we choose not to speak.
Mm-hmm. Right. In your research for the book, you found that, I really found this interesting. You found that the most common reasons given for people, you know, not engaging in conversations about religion and spirituality, they fall into three kind of broad categories. And you talk about indifference and ignorance and avoidance. And you break these down quite a bit in detail in the book. And for our limited time today, we can't get too deep into it, but I'm just wondering if you, Jonathan, can share more about these reasons for not engaging in conversation about spirituality or religions and these categories.
Yeah, so I tried to break them into broad categories. Indifference says, I don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, if you said to somebody, what do you think grace is? And they're like, why are you asking me that? I don't care. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I don't want to talk about, I don't want to know, I don't want to engage in these conversations. They're irrelevant to me. They don't matter to me. Mm-hmm. I just want to go live my life. Yeah. A lot of people encounter that. They go, what's this podcast about? No, nope, not interested. Yeah. Not relevant. Yeah. I'd rather listen to, you know, the Kardashians or whatever. There's a choice, right? That there's just, there's an apathy that runs underneath it. Ignorance is when somebody says, you know, it may or may not be important to me, but I just don't know. I don't understand that word. And as a result, you're not going to talk about things if you don't care. Mm-hmm. You're not going to talk about things if you don't know.
Right.
And avoidance is when you feel a kind of repulsion, right? Mm. Where you actually have a kind of reaction to it, you know? So if you say something like sin, particularly somebody who grew up, let's say, in a fundamentalist environment where that was weaponized,
right.
Where that was an instrument of harm, you may have a physical reaction or an emotional reaction. You go, no, thanks. I don't like that. I don't want to have a conversation about that. I don't want to use that word. I don't want to hear that word. And so it's not that you don't care. You care very much. It's not that you don't know what it means. You've got a meaning that's been put to that word for you, but you have a visceral reaction. And so those are the three broad categories when you say, why would somebody not have a spiritual or religious conversation? Typically, it's going to fall in one of those kind of three broad umbrellas.
And I find just, you know, working as a parish priest, those three things show up in the church community.
I can say...
You know, we're going to have an Advent study, and there'll be those that say, no interest. And there'll be those that say, Advent, I don't really get that whole thing. And then they'll just say, no, I don't do studies, right? Just completely avoid it. Yeah, I don't want anybody to know that I don't know anything. Right. So you see that even within the church community.
Well, and if you lay a kind of pastoral or ministerial lens over this, you have three tasks that are sort of crystallized by each of those, right? Mm-hmm. You have to get people to care.
Yeah,
that's step one. Yeah. If they don't care, then you've already lost.
Forget it.
It doesn't matter if they know or don't know.
Yeah.
So you have to get them to care. Then you have to do, you know, we would call it religious education, you know, in a seminary class, called religious education, right?
Yeah.
So or spiritual formation. So you've got to tell them what it is you're talking about and why it matters to their lives. Why does it matter? What does it mean? And then avoidance, you have to begin to undo the bad work that somebody else has done.
Exactly.
So you have to do not just education, but you have to deal with miseducation,
which means
you're not just, and I'm not the first person to say this, but the task of religion is as much about unlearning, helping people unlearn as it is helping them learn. And so because we have so many, to go back to our previous point, because we have so many Christianities today,
that's right.
Yeah. Oftentimes when you receive someone into your church, you're not just receiving a Christian who's coming from Christianity. You're receiving somebody from another Christianity that when they have used these words, they have given them all kinds of definitions and connotations, many of which you would totally reject. And so you have the work of unlearning before you can help them to learn.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's so true.
Well, I was just thinking, Rob, we just went through this back in the spring through our Advent time Lenten time. Mm-hmm. During COVID, we picked up some parishioners through online and so on, and then they started coming here. And here we do the full sort of triduum through Holy Week, and a part of that was the foot washing. Mm-hmm. And one of our new parishioners, a dear woman who's become very involved here, had a very traumatic, awful experience of that in a evangelical sort of setting. The work that we had to do together to unpack what that was for her to be able to come to the liturgy and participate in that and not feel shattered. So it's that very thing you're talking about, Jonathan, that it was, you know, she came with all of the beautiful belovedness that she brought, but she also brought all this, as we all do. We all bring our past with us in terms of what trauma has informed us from the church sometimes, right? So there's a lot to do there.
Oh, yeah, there is. That's the work, isn't it? One of the interesting images you use in the book that I really love too, the image or metaphor of followers of Jesus as fire carriers. Mm-hmm. And it's an image from the final scene of the movie No Country for Old Men, which I love too. And you write this, words are the fires we carry to each other, but the embers do not originate with us. They were handed to us by messengers from generations past, and now we pass them on to others. I love that, considering we were just coming, we're just coming out of All Saints, All Souls this week, and talking about
Hallowtide, yeah.
Things, yeah. When we lose our spiritual vocabulary, we lose much more than words. We lose the power of speaking grace, forgiveness, love, and justice over others. Sacred speech is in crisis as millions of fire carriers have decided to extinguish their torches. Mm-hmm. But a lingering question remains unanswered. So what? Why does it matter if we speak God anyway? Could you talk more about this wonderful image and why speaking God matters today?
Yeah, I like this idea, because the metaphor for me, you know, as I say in there, fires can heat our homes or burn them to the ground, I think is the way that I put it, right?
Yeah.
And so I love this, because in many ways, if you think about the fires that we have received from our ancestors, our forebears, there's always a mix of that, right? Mm-hmm. There were the ways that the spiritual vocabulary or these spiritual practices or these traditions kind of singed us or burned us, perhaps, you know, out of good intentions. And then there were the ways that they kind of warmed us and stirred us and shaped us and grew us up and matured us. And so, what I think about, is not just the image of fire as something that's passed to us, which is important, I think, because we have to remember that it didn't start with us, that we are a part of some great tradition or history or story in which we are coming in the middle of the tale, in the middle of the book. And that reminds us that we have an obligation not just to take this thing, but to pass it on, and to do so in a way that would do a little less burning down and a little more warming up. But I think it also sort of, I think it also gives us the ability to think of this as something that should be handled in reverence, mm-hmm. right? With care. Mm-hmm. Because most of us, you think about it, if you were to use fire in your home, even if you were building a fire and you do that every day, it's something that you would do with care. You would be thinking about what you're doing. You'd bring awareness and attention and a kind of consciousness to it. And so oftentimes that's not what we do. When we speak God, we sort of hurry through it. We use language carelessly, or as I say in the book, like, how often do we stop and say, what am I saying when I'm saying what I'm saying? Yeah. What am I saying when I'm saying this? And intent can be different than impact.
Yes.
Not just what do I intend to say, but how is this impacting this person? How are they receiving it based on the way that this word may have been used or misused or abused in our world? And so I think that the metaphor for fire, the metaphor of fire for me really kind of cracked this open in a number of ways as I began to think about it as a metaphor for this sort of carrying forth of sacred speech throughout history. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that image of the power of words, right? Like the weightiness of it and what it actually does. You describe humanity as word-shaped beings who live word-shaped lives within word-shaped communities. Human beings are unique among all of creation, of course, in that we have this ability to speak. I know others may communicate, but this speaking is unique to us. Words become critically important. You write in the book, words are one of God's holy gifts to humanity, and speaking them should be a sacred act. We drape our dreams in words. We paint murals of sorrow with them. They are humanity's carrier pigeons of dream, of information, of meaning, of emotion. We struggle to live without them. But we humans don't always wield our words well. We often speak without much thought. We spew hate speech and blaspheme, transforming the sacred act of speaking into profane behavior. We speak deceptively and unkindly. We use words to curse, to tear down, to discourage, blame, and judge. A simple no can fly from our lips with the decimating power of a shotgun shell, while a sincere yes can alter the course of a life. Our words, you go on to say, may not cause plants to sprout, but they can make hope spring forth in a human heart. God birthed us with words, and now we find ourselves in constant labor, giving birth ourselves through the power of words. When we release words into the air, like the first one spoken, they create worlds both glorious and dark. Can you say more about the power of words? When I read that, I must have read it three or four times back again, because I just absolutely loved it. I think that for someone who doesn't have a great economy of words, I waste a lot of words. I wish I had someone going around slapping me every 5 minutes saying, shut up. some James character going, boom. Words are so critically important. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so much of this for me is there's kind of two components to this. One is maybe anthropological, which is this idea that we are sort of people who are enlivened by words, tethered to words. It's one of the unique markers of human beings. And I've often, asked people the question that I asked in this book, have you ever wondered why that is? Like, why is that the unique thing about who we are? I mean, theologians have even, some of them have posited that the ability to use language may be the heart of the Imago Dei. The sort of mysterious, like, how are we? I mean, it's sort of tethered right to that story where God speaks and then says, after speaking into existence, after sort of numerous times, day after day, in this sort of poetic story, creates with words, uses the creative power of words, and then says, and now I'll make humans in my image, in our image, that this is, it is something that sets us apart. Other animals and insects and plants have ways of communicating, but the way in which we use language is so unique to who we are. It's one of the things that makes humans human. So that's the anthropological side, but I do think underneath that is a kind of theological component. And it certainly is, something that is woven into our scriptures. I mean, if you take away words, there is not a lot left in Christian practice. We've got some silence and solitude in there. but even in silence and solitude, it is the unspoken words that become central to those spiritually formative tasks, right? We're meditating in our minds on words. And so words are so important to our spirituality. They're so important to our humanity. And it may be just because they are such a ubiquitous kind of assumed part of our existence, we just don't think about them very much. We just sort of take them for granted. But if we go back to that fire metaphor, right?
Yeah.
It's when you begin to see that they're central and then you realize that they're powerful. Now you naturally have a kind of attentiveness that is inescapable, where you have to say, now we have to begin to speak in an intentional way.
Yeah.
We have to think about what we're saying when we're saying what we're saying. And, I kind of go through in the book the sort of history of the Bible and the scriptures and the ways in which you have words, the words of the prophets, the words of the commandments, words upon words upon words that shaped this community. First, our Jewish ancestors, and then, the early Christian community, the Psalms, and the way that the Psalms, the words of the Psalms have been so powerfully transformative century upon century. And if you even look at the way that the Bible uses words to talk about words.
That's right.
The tongue has the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit.
Yeah.
This wise words and thoughtless words and the power of the tongue. Yeah. It's like in between using words to sort of shape the community, the Bible continues to pause and says, oh, and by the way, a word about words.
Yeah.
Be careful how you use words, right? Because they can build up or they can destroy. They can warm or they can burn down. And it's these sort of like siren blasts that come throughout the text, trying to make sure that we don't become complacent in the ways that we're using language, the way that we're using words. And that's what I really hope that this book would do, is be one more siren blast for people who have been lulled to sleep and have forgotten the power that they hold in their tongues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you liken speaking God as a dying language, and you outline three potential ways to respond to a dying language. You outline fossilization, which is the protection of words, the substitution, which is the pitch words, and then the transformation, which is the play with words. Languages that do not change are most certainly doomed to die because they don't adapt and overcome. You make the case for a transformational approach where you write, in order to revive the vocabulary of faith, God speakers need to have open mouths and open minds. They must be willing to use the language and also willing to allow the language to change. A transformational approach to speaking God gives me clam hands. I prefer safety over scary, normal over new, regular over risky, and would be much easier if every sacred word had a uniform, universal, unchanging meaning. But this is just not how words work. The only way to revive the lexicon of faith is to revisit our most sacred terms, asking which ones need pruning, which ones need new life, which ones need space for a fresh shoot to emerge. For this, we must rely on two virtues that are in short supply these days: courage and imagination. Can you say more about that, particularly given that you describe modern Christians as, quote, children of both Merriam-Webster and King James?
Yes. Yes. So the Merriam-Webster, which I think you guys may have quoted in one of your tweets
I did. Yeah,
this interview is that, you know, if you were to say to someone, tell me what a dictionary is for, and they would say, a dictionary tells you what a word means. No, a dictionary does not tell you what a word means. A dictionary tells you how a word is used. Mm-hmm. If a dictionary told you what a word meant, you would never have to update them. Maybe you'd expand them, but you would never update them. It tells you how a word is used. And the meaning of a word is just simply, it's not an objective, sort of fixed, unchanging thing. It's something that changes over time based on usage. And I talk about the word sin, actually, in a whole chapter, and the way that that has at least three meanings that can be sort of chronologically constructed within the Christian text. And of course, now we have all kinds of ways of talking about sin. We use all these analogies and ways of describing it that are completely, completely modern and foreign to the text. And so we have to remember sometimes that what we will think about when we think about words is, well, let's just go back to what it means. And the truth is that we can decide what it means. Now, it does not mean, and I use this a little bit talking, I believe it's C.S. Lewis who uses the picture of a tree and how meaning is sort of like new branches that come out over time, but they're always connected to this thing. So it's not that like red becomes blue, but that over time, red becomes different shades of red in our hands, right? That we begin to say that wasn't exactly right. And words can change over time, not to become something totally different or something contradictory, but they begin to point to the same reality in a new way, in a fresh way, right? And so we get to decide as a community what these words will mean by choosing as a community to how these words will be used. And most people aren't engaging in what I'm calling here wordplay. Right. So instead, we either go, I don't like that word, I'm just not going to use it anymore. So we go to a lot of churches who go, well, we don't talk about fill in the blank. Yeah. And that's okay. Sometimes that can be fine. Sometimes you have to set aside something for a period of time because it's just there's so many hurdles. And maybe the work of pastoral ministry requires that you have to do the work of ministry and you don't have time to unravel all of the history around a word. So you have to get creative about the way that you sort of get at a thing.
Yeah.
But words are an approximation. Yeah. Right? We're just moving toward the thing, the real thing that we're pointing at. Mm-hmm. Words are fingers. Words are signposts. Words are arrows. They're not the thing. They're just pointing to the thing. Or I think as I say in the book, words are like empty cardboard boxes. Meaning, yes, is the thing we put inside.
Inside the box,
words, yeah, don't have meaning. They hold meaning.
Yes.
And so we get to choose what meaning gets put into these boxes by deciding as a community, sitting down and saying, what are the ways that we've used this word that have been not helpful? Yeah. What are the ways we've used this word that have inflicted pain on people? What are the ways that we've used this word that have been self-serving, that have, mm-hmm, propped up an institution or have served to benefit those in power? What are the ways that we need to reimagine this word or play with this word or allow this word to evolve in our hands so that it is more good in the world? It's more loving. It's more true. It feels more consistent with the God that we believe exists. And that's an active process. Yes. So it's not either, do you like this word or not? That's a passive process. I mean, it's active in that you make a choice and then you move on.
Right.
The active process is an ongoing process that communities should be doing and in history have done, where we've actively played with these words together so, mm-hmm, that we can own their meanings, even if their meanings are different from the ones that we received maybe as a child or in the other Christianity that we came from.
Right. And what's interesting too for me when I hear you say that is that because that's non-binary, right? Like that's not, it's not either it means this or it doesn't, or it has this meaning or that meaning. It's somewhere perhaps between that or outside of that. And, you know, fossilization, which is, you know, going back to the beginning of our podcast, like is that a lot of what we hear from the hard religious right is trying to fossilize these words back to, you know, their original meaning and, you know, sort of this outrage about anything. And they've used woke as a dirty word now. Like it's just so, it's interesting to me to sort of whole play with the words that you talk about is great. Now, the second half of this book, really what you do is you pull through a whole bunch of these, including words like creed, prayer, pain, disappointment, mystery, God, fall, sin, grace, brokenness, blessed, neighbor, pride, saint, confession, spirit, family. There's a lot of different words that we use, lost. And in the interest of time, what we thought we'd do is just give a couple of examples of how you do that wordplay with a couple of these. And one of your chapters, we'll take the one God, which the chapter is titled, God, Tattooed Jesus and a Full Narrative Deity. I was like, that is a great title right there. I couldn't wait to get into what it says, Tattooed Jesus. So you write this in the chapter, you say, the way God is perceived can have devastating effects on the God speakers themselves. When we use our words to speak about a terribly angry God, we often become terribly angry people. If we speak about a God who rules by fear, we become people who live by fear. The tattoo Jesus reference I really loved, and I hadn't seen this before in the whole Mark Driscoll conversation, but for our listeners who don't know, Mark Driscoll was an evangelical megachurch pastor who at one point said, and you quote him, in Revelation, Jesus is a prize fighter with a tattoo down his leg, a sword in his hand, and a commitment to make someone bleed. This is a guy I can worship. I cannot worship the hippie diaper halo Christ because I cannot worship a guy I can beat up. Like, that is just incredible that anybody would say that out loud, let alone think it. But anyway, you advocate for a whole narrative understanding of God, which I really like that expression, the whole narrative. One that sets our minds at ease, calms our nerves, and I like how you use the word tattoo here, and tattoos our hearts with the compassionate kindness of a deity who whips up in a tornado of love and mercy. Can you say more about how God is perceived and why it matters so much?
Yeah, you know, there's a quote that I use in this book, which is one of my favorite quotes from kind of a 20th century white guy, A.W. Tozier, who says, comes to mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us.
Yeah.
And, you know, it reminds me of, there was a book by Rob Bell years ago.
Yes.
You know, like, what do we talk about? What are we talking about when we talk about God?
Yeah.
What are we really talking about? I was out with a guy last night at dinner who was raised Mormon. And then on 9/11, the whole family became atheist and said, we cannot believe in a God anymore. And I said, oh, that's so, you know, interesting. Like, what do you believe in? And he said, well, you know, I don't believe that this is all there is, but I don't know what is beyond this. And I think maybe there are people on other planets. And I think, you know, maybe reincarnation is a thing. And I said, okay, you know, let's like pull everything back. Like, do you believe in love?
Mm.
And isn't that a mystery? Two people falling in love with each other. If you really want to get to a mystery from an evolutionary biological standpoint, which no one can explain, is why does beauty make us feel awe?
Mm.
There's no reason evolutionarily that we should pause and look at a sunset and want to cry.
Right.
Mm. There's no reason that a painting should captivate us and haunt us and keep us up at night.
Mm.
Why does that do what it does? And what do you call that thing that it does inside you that can't be measured, you know, with an instrument? If you peel back all the layers, if you believe in love, well, I believe God is love.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe in beauty, I think God's the author of that, right? That this is the Christian thing. Just there's an old phrase. It's just one finger pointing at the moon, right? Mm-hmm. And I have friends who use a lot of different fingers. Some use a finger called universe. Some use a finger called source. Mm-hmm. Some use a finger called mystery with a capital M.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not exactly the same thing,
right?
But they're different arrows pointing to the same reality in different ways. And so when we think about how we conceive of God, how we conceive the realest real, the capital R real at the base of everything, not just a being, because I don't know that B is something that God does. Mm-hmm. But if you were to get down to the very essence of this thing, it's like God is the connective tissue. God is the interstitial fluid of all reality, that thing that we can't explain, that no one can seem to kind of wrap their minds around, that thing. How do you perceive that thing? I mentioned in the book from Baylor University, kind of the four ways once people get to a God concept, once they move beyond these kind of depersonalized fingers pointing to the moon, right? So source, for example, which is a popular one among my friends, or universe, when they get to a kind of God concept that begins to kind of take shape and personalize, you've got an authoritarian God, a critical God, a distant God, or a benevolent God. Mm-hmm. And it's based on how angry or temperamental that God might be, and how engaged or disengaged that God might be. So, for example, a lot of people who think of source, they may think of that God as sort of disengaged, but, you know, benevolent. So that would be, source is a distant God, low level of anger, low level of engagement.
Yeah.
You've got a critical God, high level of anger, but stays out of my way, low level of engagement.
Yeah.
You've got a high level of anger and a high level engagement. That's what I was raised with, right? Mm. Authoritarian God. That's God, he's the chess master who's like very easily pissed off.
Mm.
And then you've got a benevolent God, which I think is the true God, the God of Jesus, the God embodied by Jesus, which is a low level of anger and a high level of engagement. Now, not engagement in the sense that God is moving the chess pieces. I'm not using that in a kind of Calvinistic a sense. I know there are probably some children of John Calvin who are listening in, and that's not how I mean that. I mean that in that if God is the connective tissue, then God is connected to all the things. God is a part of, is tied into, is enmeshed with all the things. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of God is a different kind of God. But what we find is depending on the concept you have of God, as Tozer said, it becomes one of the most important things about you. Because, for example, if you believe in a God with a high level of anger, a la Mark Driscoll, you become, for example, a la Mark Driscoll, an abusive asshole pastor, right? So you begin, if you believe that everything in the universe is made up of that thing, and you digest that and eat that, it becomes a kind of part of who you are. And so you begin to express the thing that you believe in.
Right.
And so we believe in a benevolent God, I think, or we have to believe in a benevolent God. We have to be, you know, not, I don't mean this in the evangelical sense, but we have to be kind of chief evangelists for a benevolent God, because that benevolent God makes us less angry, more at peace, kinder, more compassionate, more generous, right? That it actually changes who we become when we think about the real in those terms.
And that is more important now than ever, right? Like, I mean, that need, the need for that, as we talked about that polarization. The other thing I was thinking of as you were talking was John Caputo, who says, you know, God doesn't exist, God insists. And persist, right? It's like, and because instead of this distant off, it's this insistence of God, right? It's instead of having to prove something that's way off. But again, all this wordplay to me is so beautiful. And each chapter, folks, what a book. Rob's got one too.
Just one more just before we let you go, Jonathan, because the other word of importance is neighbor. Very important. And you title the chapter Neighbor, Mr. Rogers and the Global Refugee Crisis. And you begin the chapter by writing about your experiences, because you did some interviews with refugees in a Lebanese tent settlement at the Syrian border. And you finish by writing about Mr. Rogers in the chapter. And I want to read just a small excerpt. You write, "As neighbors, we are bound to each other by humanity, not just proximity. Some in our culture believe we become stronger by being more inward focused, that building walls and closing borders is better than the biblical mandate to invite all to come to the table. And when it comes to neighborliness, we are connected by need, not nearness." We began to understand neighbor in this way. If we could do that, it would be a beautiful day in our global neighborhood. Can you say more about this, you know, need to understand that word neighbor and sit in difficult conversations, which we often do with our neighbors?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to sort of get people to think about, not that they're the only options, but I talked about, you know, it's the question Jesus was asked. You know, you would think after Jesus sort of answers it, even though he answers it with a story, you'd think we'd go, well, that sort of settles it.
It's pretty big.
We keep asking it. Who is my neighbor? Is the person at the border? Are those children my neighbor? And if they're my neighbor, do I have an obligation? I mean, if you took the guy who lives across the hall, if you were going to go put his kid in a cage, I would be out in the streets, right? Trying to protect his children. And yet we do that to someone on the border and we go, not my problem, or they deserve it.
Or put them on a plane and fly them to Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, that's right. Right. So, and it goes back to whether or not we may say it, but do we actually believe that they're our neighbor? Now, the problem can be if you begin to think about neighbor as something that's based on humanity rather than proximity or need rather than nearness, it's exhausting.
Yes.
I can't walk three blocks in this neighborhood without encountering a lot of neighbors who need my help.
How do you live practically?
And that gets really difficult. That's where it gets hard, because we have to accept that we love our neighbors consistently and intentionally, but often imperfectly, just because of sort of what it means to kind of live life. But we have to constantly be saying, I think for me, it's a spiritual practice. I just say, okay, God, wake me up. to my neighbors, to the ones that I am tempted not to see, to the ones that I'm tempted to overlook or to walk past that you need me to stop and talk to. And so much of this for me was based on watching Mr. Rogers grow up. You know, I grew up in a very conservative evangelical home as a child who didn't have the word gay at that time to put to it, but knew that I was different in a way that made me feel kind of estranged and out of place. It was like some days I was just like waiting for my actual family to come pick me up, you know? As odd as that sounds, I think a lot of people can sort of relate to that, where you feel like a stranger in your own home, in your own church, in your own body. And every day, a Presbyterian minister, an ordained Presbyterian minister, would come on PBS and he would say, today's been a special day, right? You've made today a special day by just your being you. And I like you just the way you are. It was that care for me, who had no nearness, but I had a need.
Right.
Who had no proximity, but had humanity. It was the care that he expressed for me that on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that made me realize later in life that was somebody who understood what it meant to be a neighbor. And that's what Jesus meant when he said, this is your neighbor.
And I would say he also understood what it was to be an evangelist in the truest sense of the word. Right? Like, I mean, I think that that's the thing, is I hear you talk about your personal experience of listening to Mr. Rogers. Like, I just think, well, now there's a guy who's telling the good news. You know, not screaming about tattoos and beating the piss out of people.
And to us up in Canada, it was, we've talked about this in the podcast, it was Romper Room.
We had the same room,
We had the lady that held the little mirror up and could see Kevin and Ian and Jonathan. She said our name. And
she would say, you wait for her to say, because she'd just rattle off different names every week.
Hey, Jonathan, we really appreciate you giving us the time today. The book is Learning to Speak God from Scratch, Why Sacred Words Are Vanishing and How We Can Revive Them. We commend that to our listeners and all your other great works. And look for Jonathan and read his stuff. And hey, thanks for giving us the time today.
And what's coming up, Jonathan? There must be something coming up,
You know, there may be, there's, in terms of my next book, I'm working on an idea right now. We'll see. That one is, let me see if I can make it happen first, and I'll tell you more about it. But I will say, I did this week, Monday, I've never talked, this is, you're the first people to hear this.
Breaking news, folks.
Breaking news. On Monday of this week, I agreed to a book deal for a children's book that I have written, that I hope will maybe carry on that legacy,
Mr. Rogers.
That I was handed by Fred Rogers. That will come out in the spring of 2024, I hope that will be an inspirational book. So we'll see. So
that's really cool.
Can look good.
And what has to be coming up is we have to get you to Canada. Like, there has to be, there has to be an opportunity to have an event with.
Won't you
Jonathan
be our neighbor, Jonathan?
Won't you be our neighbor?
I would love to. I would love to.
We feel like neighbors who have crazy people living in the basement.
That's right. You keep hitting us with your broom.
I keep waiting for the police to come and do an eviction or something, but it's never going to happen. But listen, thanks so much for your time, Jonathan. You're a treat, and we hope you'll come back and join us again.
I would love that. Thank you. It's been a real gift.
And again, thanks to Jonathan. Much appreciated, and really want people to get out and get that book and learn more about him and his writing. And as we said at the top, you know, he's got a lot of articles out there on different sites as well. So if you liked what you heard, you can find more, certainly, if you do a little Google search. But we're really appreciative of Jonathan today.
Just remember, when you see him on CNN next, you go, you know what? He was on the Vicar's Crossing.
That's right. Hey, thanks to our sponsors today, to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. To the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan come together to worship and serve. And to Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. Guys, that's a wrap. Good to see y'all. We'll be back for episode 5 sometime. But until we meet again, I'm Rob Henderson from Holy Trinity St. Stephen's.
Kevin George here from St. Aidan's Anglican Church.
My name is Ian. Thank you all for listening.
Hey, Kevin, remember, always look both ways
before you cross the street.
Woo. Thank you for listening. Our hosts are Kevin George and Rob Henderson. Our producer and composer is myself, Ian, with original artwork done by Elizabeth Dodman. If you have any questions or want to know where to find us, tweet us at Vickers Crossing or find us on Facebook at The Vickers Crossing. If you have any other questions about anything heard on this podcast, leave us a comment or look in the description to find out more. Thanks!